This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
It is a pleasure to be with you today. This is Joel Hilliker. Today we're going to talk about a fascinating subject with a huge impact on America's future. Are our elections in this country, America, clean and fair? An excellent article by Real Clear Investigations last week on July 11th was called Who Will Clean Up America's Voter Rolls? It examines the issue of voter fraud, and it gives a remarkable look at something our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, has talked a lot about, just how there is a faction within this country willing to do just about anything to seize power, even if it means breaking the law. We'll also hear a report from Andrew Miller about Charles Darwin, the father of the theory of natural selection. Even though most people think of evolution as rational as opposed to irrational religion, it's worth looking at the origin of Darwin's theory to get a more accurate view. We'll also have a conversation with nutritionist Jorg Mardian about salt. We've been told in recent decades that salt is bad for you. It raises your blood pressure. It causes heart disease. Well, Jorg says there's more to it than that, and he cites recent studies showing the tremendous health benefits of salt. At the end of the program, I'll share how my experience in summer camp as a teen helped my relationship with my parents. We'll begin, though, by talking about voter fraud. In a recent program, I talked about America's Constitution, how the founders structured this document in a way to avoid the problems that had plagued governments throughout history. Well, one issue they wrestled with mightily was the role of democracy in America's government. History shows that strict democracy leads to the tyranny of the majority. It leads to mob rule. And, well, the mob isn't exactly known for its wisdom. America's founders implemented elements of democracy. They had many of the leaders accountable to the people, the president, the members of the House and the Senate and the legislature. But even then, the process of democracy was mitigated by the Electoral College. So there were safety measures put in place to prevent the calamities that democracy tends to create. Now, all of that effort that the founders put into safeguarding the government in America is being overwhelmed today in a few very dangerous ways, and virtually all of them are spearheaded by the Democratic Party, which is significant, as we'll see. First, we hear a lot the idea being pushed that anyone and everyone should be able to vote. They want to lower the voting age from 18 to 16. They want felons to be able to vote. They want illegal immigrants to be able to vote. They want to do away with voter ID requirements. So anyone who wants to ensure accuracy in voting is accused of racism or trying to suppress the voices of ethnic minorities. They want to do away with the Electoral College. So that would take power away from the states. It would transfer power from most of the country to the high-density population centers, which tend to be more liberal. And it would make voter fraud a whole lot easier. So on and on and on, you see many of these efforts being undertaken. And of course, all of them tend to favor increases in votes for Democrats. At the same time, there's a tendency to ignore the results of votes that don't align with political outcomes they dislike. So on one hand, it's like we need to go strict democracy. Everyone gets a chance to vote. And on the other hand, you know, if we don't like the results of that vote, then we just ignore it. So they push their agenda through unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats and lifetime appointed judges. When you have duly elected officials who pass policies or laws that they dislike, they simply ignore them. And of course, probably the most notable example to this day, they will not accept the results of the last presidential election. They're doing everything possible to undermine the will of 63 million American voters. This is a growing political force in America today that is sure that it's right. It's absolutely convinced in the righteousness of its cause. It views anyone who disagrees as something less than human, certainly unenlightened, probably racist. And it's determined to implement its policies, its version of what is right, and it won't even let the law stand in its way. And I mentioned this article underlining this point. It appeared last week, July 11th, published by Real Clear Investigations. And it's talking about the problem of vote fraud. This article, it presents it like this is something that both sides of the political aisle do. But everything in the article is about Democrats. It's talking about how across the United States, Democrats are engaged in really what amounts to a conspiracy to enable voter registration fraud. They're ignoring voter registration laws. They've gotten help in the past from the Clinton administration, the Obama administration, in an effort to steal elections. So here are some facts about this. The article begins, Los Angeles County has too many voters. An estimated 1.6 million, according to the latest calculations, which is roughly the population of Philadelphia. That's the difference between the number of people on the county's voter rolls and the actual number of voting age residents. 1.6 million phantom voters in one county. 1.6 million more people who are on the voter rolls than the actual number of voting age residents. Now, across California, voter registration rate is 101%. So there are more people registered to vote than actual voting age residents. In eight states, as well as the District of Columbia, you have voter registration rates above 100%. 15% of America's counties that publish reliable data have registration rates above 100%. Back in 2012, a Pew study found that 24 million voter registrations in the U.S. are no longer valid or are significantly inaccurate. That's one in eight voter registrations. So that's more than the population of Florida. That's more than the population of New York State. And those figures included 1.8 million dead people who are registered to vote. It includes 2.75 million people who are registered to vote in two different states. This article says, in sum, America's voter rolls are a mess, and everyone knows it. While voter registration rates over 100% are not proof of fraud, they certainly create opportunities that otherwise wouldn't exist, such as voting twice in different precincts, or the potential for requesting and filling out invalid absentee ballots. So we have a lot of people today that are warning about threats to free and fair elections. We hear about foreign interference in our elections. Well, here's a solution. How about just obeying federal law by updating the voter rolls, making sure that the rolls of the people who are supposed to be voting are accurate, as federal law dictates? And we'll talk about that in a moment. The problem is, whenever anybody's tried to fix this, Democrats have accused them of stealing elections. For example, this article talks about the Georgia governor race. In 2018, Brian Kemp won the race to become Georgia's governor. However, to this day, Democrats have not conceded this election. His rival is Stacey Abrams. She's quite a darling in the Democratic Party. She's accused him of stealing the election. She said more than a million citizens found their names stripped from the rolls. And senior Democrats have accused Kemp of stealing the election this way. A lot of them, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, they've all said the same thing. Well, more than a million citizens were stripped from the rolls. Well, the truth is that Brian Kemp did remove 1.4 million people from the voter rolls when he was Secretary of State of Georgia. But what was he doing? He was enforcing voter registration rules. He was following the law. These are rules that Democrats were ignoring. And this Real Clear Investigations article says no evidence of wrongdoing has emerged. So all these senior Democrats are launching these serious accusations. They're saying he stole the election and they will not concede this race with no evidence of wrongdoing. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution decided to check if actual voters had been blocked from voting. You know, 1.4 million who were removed from the voter rolls in order to enforce those voter registration rules. Well, were they actual people? And so the Atlanta Journal-Constitution picked 50 names at random from those 1.4 million people. And here's what they found. Out of the 50, 20 of them were ineligible to vote in Georgia. 17 had moved out of the state. Two of them were convicted of felonies, and they were ineligible to vote. One of them had died. So that altogether, that's 40 out of the 50 that they looked at. And the other 10 people they couldn't find because they'd moved so many times. They had phone numbers that didn't work. So there's plenty of evidence there that what he did was exactly right in just enforcing the registration rules that were in place. And yet the Democrats will not accept that. And they will not accept his victory in the governor's race in Georgia. Now, Congress has passed laws to prevent the problem of inaccurate voter rolls, but Democratic state officials have refused to follow these laws. Back in 1993, Congress passed the National Voter Registration Act. And this law set out how people register to vote. And it tried to resolve the problem of the fact that people who move don't usually write to the electoral authorities where they used to live to tell them they moved. They're no longer eligible to vote. So this law basically tries to solve the problem in a pretty gentle way. It says states should review their lists. If they suspect that someone's registration is no longer valid, they send a letter asking if they're eligible to vote. And if they don't get a reply, then they're listed as inactive. Now, people who are listed as inactive can still vote. If they vote in any of the next two federal elections, then they're removed from the inactive list. It's only after they miss two federal elections and they don't vote that they're completely removed from the electoral rolls. So it's a pretty soft solution to a common problem. But the Democrats ignore this rule, even such a soft solution as this. This is what this Real Clear Investigations article says. Robert Popper, a former deputy chief of the voting section in the Civil Rights Division in the Department of Justice, who now works on voting issues for Judicial Watch, said the most aggressive efforts to stop this law have been led by Democrats. He says the willing of Democratic administrations to just make war on the NVRA, the National Voter Registration Act, is appalling. Back in 1998, the Clinton administration allowed California to reinterpret this law so that people would never be removed from the elector rolls. They would never be considered inactive. And since that time, many states, including California, have done almost nothing to keep their rolls up to date. In 2012, a Democrat was elected as Secretary of State in Kentucky, Allison Lundergan Grimes. And Popper says at that point, back in 2012, by all accounts, they simply stopped designating people inactive and removing them after two general federal elections. They just flat out stopped. The Obama administration played a key role in allowing states to ignore the law on voter registrations. Under President Trump, the Department of Justice is starting to try and enforce these voter registration laws. But before then, the last DOJ action on the issue was under President Bush. President Obama did absolutely nothing on this. Real Clear Investigation says the Obama DOJ did so little to enforce the law that Justice's own Office of the Inspector General investigated the matter. That's the OIG. Its report presented evidence that former Obama Deputy Assistant Attorney General Julie Fernandez said at a July 2009 meeting that Section 8 cases should not be brought. Section 8 of the law requires states to perform voter registration maintenance. And she just said, we're not going to enforce that law. She said, this is according to a report on a meeting that took place under her, that she did not care about and was not interested in upholding this law. She said, this law does nothing to help voters. We have no interest in that. So the DOJ's Inspector General's report into this matter says 10 attorneys who attended the meeting with Fernandez told the OIG that they interpreted Fernandez's comments to be a clear directive that division leadership would not approve Section 8 list maintenance cases in the future. So this goes up pretty high in the Obama administration. President Trump has spoken out quite often against voter fraud, but to this point, the DOJ still hasn't made it a high priority, even under President Trump. Judicial Watch, which Popper is a part of now, this is a conservative group that investigates misconduct by government officials, has been trying to bring cases to enforce this law because the Department of Justice won't do it. And this article says, in 2017, Judicial Watch sued Montgomery County, Maryland, to gain access to voter registration data it was refusing to release, despite the fact that NVRA mandates that it be publicly available. Montgomery County has a voter registration rate exceeding 100%. Last fall, Maryland's Attorney General, Brian Frosch, put forth a remarkable court filing demanding that Judicial Watch, quote, identify any Russian nationals or agents of the Russian government with whom you have communicated concerning this lawsuit. The Judicial Watch basically says, we want to see that you're upholding the law. And Maryland basically says, you must be colluding with the Russians. And Judicial Watch responded that Maryland officials are using a baseless allegation to retaliate against an organization and its supporters because of their conservative political views, a violation of the First Amendment. So because the government isn't policing itself, basically you have this private entity that's trying to do so. And this man, Popper, he says the federal government should be doing the job. It should be leading the enforcement work. Namely, quote, the 30 lawyers at the U.S. Department of Justice voting section where I used to work. But he says, I like to joke with people that the NVRA is one of the few instances of a federal agency undercutting deliberately the statute that gives it authority and power. You don't find the post office undercutting the statute that authorizes the existence of the post office, but you do find this with the Department of Justice. In other words, you know, government departments are always trying to grab more power. And here you have one case where they don't want more power. They're actually not interested in enforcing the laws that are meant to protect our democratic processes and prevent people from stealing elections. Now, why in the world would Democrats be standing in the way of laws intended to prevent voter fraud? Why would they do this? Well, this is really consistent with behavior that we've seen over many, many years, a lot of evidence about vote fraud by Democrats. Just to take one example, we wrote about this back in 2009. ACORN, that's the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, had close links with President Obama. It was investigated for voter registration fraud. And at that time, back in 2009, 70 ACORN workers had been convicted for fraud. 70. So this is one example where you see Democrats at the highest levels that are doing all they can to make it easy for people to commit voter fraud. You have Democrat organizations that are found guilty of carrying out that fraud. And really, this is something the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been talking about for quite some time. This power grab by people who have no respect for law. I'll just read one quote from an article he wrote back in May, June 2018, our Trumpet edition. The article called Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily, we are getting a hard look at just what the radical left is willing to do in order to seize power and stay in power. They have no respect for the rule of law. They believe they are above the law. It is no exaggeration to say that such contempt for the nation's founding principles is a threat to the republic. Mr. Fleury actually wrote about this back in 2001. If you've been a longtime Trumpet reader, you'll remember, and it's a chapter in his booklet, No Freedom Without Law. This was right after the election between George W. Bush and Al Gore. And you might remember, if you go back a ways, the chaos in Florida that followed that election. Democrats doing everything possible to win that election by throwing armies of lawyers at the situation. They were looking for any way to sway the results of that election their way. And Mr. Fleury saw all the way back at that time the fact that this reflected a lawlessness in this country. And he said it was going to get a whole lot worse. The title of that chapter in No Freedom Without Law is Justice and Our Evolving Constitution. He was very strongly condemning of this idea that the Constitution is a living document, that it can be endlessly reinterpreted in order to suit the needs of whatever is happening at the time. That was what was really the talk at that time. Al Gore was talking about just how we should not be too constrained by the law of the land. Go back and read that article, or read that chapter in that booklet. It was written over 18 years ago, and it's incredibly relevant. He talked about the importance of upholding the Constitution and the law of the land, how important it is to preserve the rule of law. And we're seeing more and more and more evidence of this anti-law, lawless movement in action in America today. And it's definitely something to watch for in the months ahead as we approach yet another election in this country. What a disaster we create when we throw out the law and our leaders just do whatever is right in their own eyes. And they won't even let the law stand in their way.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Is evolution rational and religion irrational? A look at the origins of evolutionary theory provides some insight as to the answer, as we'll now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
Most people with college degrees say evolution is rational science. And they say that the Bible's account of creation is irrational religion. They think Charles Darwin liberated people from religious superstition by allowing evidence and logic to guide his thinking. In 2009, Harvard professor Janet Brown urged her listeners to use the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth to reaffirm their faith in him as a figure of rational science. But who was Charles Darwin? What motivated Charles Darwin? What you're about to hear is not known by most people, even students of biology. Evolutionists want this information kept secret. Contrary to popular belief, it was not scientific evidence or rational thinking that caused Charles Darwin to throw out the Bible. It was confusion over why God allows people to suffer. Now, Charles Darwin was born in England on February 12th in 1809. His father was not religious, and his grandfather, Erasmus, believed in the theory of transmutation. This theory said one species could change into another over many generations. But Charles' mother was a Christian who taught him to pray and read the Bible. And Charles clung to his mother's Unitarian beliefs when he went off to medical school. While at the University of Edinburgh, Charles read his grandfather's theories, but he wasn't convinced of them. In his book Zoonomia, Erasmus Darwin had written that animals could pass on characteristics they acquired during their life to their offspring. He condemned religion as a psychological disease. Especially, he condemned the belief that unbelievers burn forever in hell. Now, eventually, Charles Darwin dropped out of medical school, and his father sent him to Cambridge University to become a priest. At Cambridge, Charles studied William Paley's natural theology and the 39 Articles of the Anglican Church. Paley offered proof of God's existence by arguing that a creation requires a creator the same as a watch requires a watchmaker. And this book impressed Charles. But he wasn't as sure about the 39 Articles of the Anglican Church. Now, these articles proclaimed that Christ went down into hell after his crucifixion, and Charles reasoned that maybe his grandfather was wrong about one species transmuting into another, but he wasn't so sure that his grandfather was wrong about hell. Charles still generally believed the Bible, but he was beginning to have doubts about a God who would eternally torment people. After Charles graduated, one of his botany professors arranged for him to work as an unpaid naturalist on the HMS Beagle. Before the ship departed, the captain gave Charles a copy of Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology. And this is when his religious beliefs really began to change. Now, Lyell was a Scottish geologist who hated the Bible and, in his own words, wanted to free science from the old dispensation of Moses. Lyell's book argued that rocks and geological formations were formed gradually by natural forces over millions of years, instead of being created in great catastrophes like Noah's flood. Now, Lyell had no way of proving this assertion, but Darwin's mind was still grappling with doubts about what the Anglican Church taught about hell, so he began to accept some of Lyell's arguments and doubt the book of Genesis. Charles would later write in his autobiography, "During these 2 years, I was led to think much about religion. While on board the Beagle, I was quite orthodox, but I had gradually come by this time to see that the Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the world, with the Tower of Babel, the rainbow as a sign, etc., etc., and its attributing to God the feelings of a vengeful tyrant, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus." Now, after rejecting the book of Genesis, Charles still believed that God created all forms of life in separate acts of creation. But as he studied finches in the Galapagos Islands, he noticed that there were different varieties of beak shapes in these songbirds, each beak shape enabling the bird to feed on a specific type of food. And so Darwin faced a choice. He could interpret what he saw as evidence that God created different shapes of finch beaks, or he could interpret what he saw as evidence that finches evolved over many generations via some accidental, unguided force. Now, when he returned home, Charles became a scientist, and his notebooks were filled with musings on transmutations and opinions on how the Bible was unreliable and contradictory. In 1838, he married his cousin, Emma Wedgeworth, and the two of them had 10 children. 3 died before age 10, and another 3 ended up unable to have children themselves. The death of his favorite daughter, Annie, had a profound effect on Charles. He attributed her sickliness to inbreeding, as he and his wife were first cousins. He began to muse on why weak organisms die and developed his ideas on transmutation. The weak die, the strong survive, children perish because nature is cruel and God has abandoned the world. These were the beginnings of Charles's theory on evolution. Charles' disillusionment with traditional Christianity had been growing for years at this point, even before Annie died. His father had died an unbeliever 3 years previously, leading Charles to once again ponder eternal punishment. And he would later write in his autobiography, "I can hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true. For if so, the plain language of the text seems to show that men who do not believe, and this would include my father, my brother, and almost all my best friends, will be everlastingly punished, and this is a damnable doctrine." Now, after Annie died, Charles began converting his transmutation notebook into a book called Origin of Species. Like his grandfather, he claimed that one species gradually changes into another over multiple generations. But he added his own ideas about how the weak die and the strong survive. He called this theory natural selection. yet it offered no explanation as to how new traits could be created. Darwin desperately hoped some future scientist would discover an explanation. By this point, he really did not want to believe in God. 7 years after he published Origin of Species, a lady wrote to ask whether she could believe in both God and evolution. And Darwin replied, "It has always appeared to me more satisfactory to look at the immense amount of pain and suffering in the world as the inevitable result of the natural sequence of events, rather than from the direct intervention of God." And this is the crux of why Charles rejected the Bible. In his book, Origin of Species was never based on rational science. It was a stab-in-the-dark hypothesis about why pain and suffering exist. By the end of his life, Charles had become agnostic. He later wrote a teacher in Liverpool, "I hardly know what to say. Though no evidence worth anything has yet, in my opinion, been advanced in favor of a living being being developed from inorganic matter, I can hardly avoid believing the possibility of this will one day be proved in accordance with the law of continuity. If it is ever found that life can originate in this world, the vital phenomena will come under some general law of nature. Whether the existence of a conscious God can be proved from the existence of so-called natural laws is a perplexing subject on which I have often thought but cannot see my way clearly." Now, almost 140 years later, no scientist has yet produced any evidence worth anything showing how a living organism can develop from inorganic matter. Evolution utterly fails to explain the origin of life and the biodiversity of our world. Erasmus Darwin's theories on inheritance of acquired characteristics is totally false. Charles Darwin's theories on evolution by means of natural selection still does not explain how new traits are formed. Without any proof or scientific knowledge whatsoever, promoters of evolution believe what they want to believe because they refuse to believe the truth. And this is completely irrational.
Thank you for that, Andrew. It is interesting history to look at, and what strikes me as you're talking about the doctrines that created doubt in Darwin's mind, they're false doctrines. You know, the idea of hellfire and his wrestling with this idea that God would torment people forever in hell. That's a valid complaint, or it's a valid criticism of you know, Orthodox Christian teaching, and even the fact that why does God allow suffering? That's a question that really a lot of Christianity doesn't have a viable answer for.
Right. I mean, it is like I said, I've mentioned at the beginning that this is really little known history. I mean, I studied biology at university for 4 years, and I study Darwin's theory in depth. They never talk about Darwin himself, or rarely do. And even what you do hear about him, it does paint kind of like this dichotomy, like I mentioned at the beginning, that, like, well, you know, religious people are all like emotion and feeling based, but Darwin's just about the facts, just about the science.
Yeah.
And then you read his life and you discover that that's actually not true at all. I mean, his scientific discoveries basically boil down to rocks are old and birds have different shaped beaks, which is hardly groundbreaking groundbreaking scientific research on either count. But you just find this picture of a man desperately grasping at whatever straws he can find to prove how life could have come about without a God, because he didn't want to believe his grandfather was burning in hell. And he didn't understand why his daughter got, it sounded like probably tuberculosis, and died at age 10.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, and when, if you were actually, this is one of those things that if you actually dig into what the Bible actually says, it says the punishment for sin is death in Romans, but not eternal life in hellfire.
Right.
So that's a completely false and unbiblical doctrine. And then there's, you go all the way back to Genesis, another book that Darwin really didn't like. And I mean, you've got this, with this sort of like mankind being cut off from God because they chose to make their own decisions. And that's why there's human suffering in this age. And so there's definitely biblical answers to these, that mm-hmm. he was not, the Anglican Church would not have taught that hell was a false doctrine. They definitely right. teach that that's true doctrine. And they would not have taught that man was cut off from God. They think God's trying to save the world now. And so if you look at it from that standpoint, it's like, well, God's trying to save the world now, but he's not doing a very good job because most people still don't believe in him, and now all those people have to burn in hell. You could see why someone wouldn't want to believe in a God like that.
Right.
He's too weak to beat the devil and save everyone now, and because he's too weak to beat the devil and save everyone now, most of humanity is burning in hell forever and ever and ever. So
yeah.
It is a damnable doctrine, as Darwin says. So he was right about a few things. But obviously he got into this point where he's looking for answers to these questions. He's not finding them in the Bible, or not even really looking for them in the Bible. And so you start coming up with your own theories that, like, all right, well, my daughter was weak, so she died, so maybe everyone who weak died, and then everyone who's strong survives, and survival of the fittest, and you just come up with these, build on these ideas until you come up with a theory that's completely irrational, to where by the end of his life he's talking about like some puddle full of ammonia molecules giving rise to the first amoebas, even though that's been known for thousands and thousands of years that life only comes from living things. Yeah. And creatures reproduce after their own kind. These are just like basic common sense observable doctrines that you've like foolishly thrown out because you're looking for answers that about false religious doctrines for places other than the Bible.
Yeah, that's right. And we do have a chapter in our booklet, Why Natural Disasters, that explains that doctrine, why God allows suffering. You can find that booklet on thetrumpet.com, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes for today's program. But as Andrew just said, those questions do have Bible answers. Even the doctrine of hellfire, you can prove that directly from the Bible in a very satisfying way, and one that makes a whole lot of sense when you put it in the whole context of God's overall plan for man. At any rate, it is fascinating to see how Darwin's theories on these things kind of emerged out of his dissatisfaction with the answers that he was receiving in his religious training. We appreciate that very much, Andrew. We've been talking to trumpet writer Andrew Miller about Charles Darwin and the irrational basis of his theory of natural selection. Andrew's working on an article for thetrumpet.com about this subject, and you can watch for that there online. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
For all of human history, salt has been recognized as being valuable, even healthful. You've heard the age-old maxims, salt of the earth and worth your salt. These are reminders of salt's enduring health qualities. But in recent decades, it's become more common to think that salt contributes to heart disease. Is it true? Is salt good or bad? The truth may surprise you. To talk about it, we have via Skype from British Columbia, certified holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. Hello.
Hello there.
So tell us about the benefits of salt to begin with.
Well, there's a lot of good benefits to salt. I mean, in simplistic terms, it keeps your blood pressure in a healthy range. But it has a host of other benefits. It helps with the fluid outside and inside of the bodily cells. It helps with brain function. You know, put a dash here and there on your food, and it improves insulin sensitivity, which is always a good thing. And it actually is very protective for heart disease. Muscle cramps, of course. It lowers blood cortisol levels, which helps you maintain a healthy body weight. And thyroid function, very important to that as well, because we know the thyroid functions on more nutrients. You know, the more nutrients we have in our food, the better our thyroid functions. So among the big ones, those are the ones.
Okay, so what about drawbacks?
Right. So one of the biggest traditional knocks against salt, it's supposed to lead to high blood pressure, heart attacks, and strokes if used in excess. I was reading an article in Cardiac Health, and they explained that when we eat salt, our body regulates its sodium level by retaining water, which increases fluid and blood in the body. So this increase in the blood makes the heart work harder, and it puts more pressure on the blood vessels. So that's the orthodox explanation for it.
Okay, it sounds like you're choosing your words carefully here.
I am.
The orthodox explanation, but your implication is that maybe that's not the only way to look at it.
No, I mean, we know that there's studies to say if we overeat on salt, there's drawbacks. I mean, that's proven. We have to have a moderate factor in this. We know if you overeat on salt, there's some studies that say you can get gastric cancer because it damages the stomach lining and it brings risk of infection. And there's also some evidence that shows excess sodium affects the bones. You know, too much in the system alters the levels of hormones. And then that seems to increase things like osteoporosis. So it's not certain, but the evidence points to that.
Okay. So can you give us an idea of, say, what would be a moderate amount or what would be considered excessive?
Well, a moderate amount is what you would put on your food to taste.
Okay.
You know? And basically, 80% of the salt that we overuse today is from restaurant foods or processed foods. So we really have no idea how much we're ingesting. They do try to say, they say, look, we're taking in about 3,300 milligrams a day. And they say 2,300 milligrams a day, which is about a teaspoon, is a safe amount. And the American Heart Association says 1,500 milligrams. That's low. I mean, that's really low for a crucial substance that the body needs. So if you're getting 80% of it from a refined diet, and we know that people are eating out much, much more today. So the problem with this refined diet is some of the food labels or restaurant foods, there's a 200% difference in what's on a label and what's true.
Mm.
So if they say, you know, you have so much in the food, you could have a 200% increase in that. There's no between the same type of food as well. So from one restaurant to the other. So if you're eating out two or three times a week, you're going to have a really, really high intake of salt. And now we're not talking about salt that you're putting on at the kitchen table on your food. 80% of it is of the excess that we're getting is when we're going out and eating out. And this stuff that's in the cans, like the soups and such, right? It's a horrendous amount. So when we're talking about a moderate amount, we're talking about stuff that you and I are adding at the kitchen table, putting a dash on for flavor, mm-hmm. you know, a good flavor. You're not really going to oversalt like that.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to come back to this maybe a little bit later and just talk about quality of salt, different kinds of salt that we might use, because you're talking about ingredients that would appear in processed foods and in restaurant food being different than what we might use ourselves. But if we could just talk a little bit about the research that maybe refutes some of the criticism that salt has gotten. What does it say as far as the effects on our health? And would there be maybe people with conditions that would need to be more careful about salt intake than others?
Oh, yes, of course. We've talked in the past about studies, and a lot of these studies, when you look at a subject like this, like salt or anything else, sometimes it's based on weak science or a biased approach to science. So it has a monetary interest in there. Mm-hmm. But now the studies on salt are sort of muddying the waters on the studies that we used to go on. You know, not only does research say there's a direct relationship between salt and heart disease, that it doesn't exist, but other studies say that the less salt that you eat, the more you increase your risk of heart disease.
Hmm.
See, so we're reducing salt to a bare nub, and heart disease is increasing.
Mm-hmm.
So something's not right. Salt deficiency also runs the risk of neurological diseases, epilepsy, brain tumors, multiple sclerosis, things like that. So we have to be really careful. There's always a moderate factor, as I've stated, but they even had studies that show that you can consume, with Russian cosmonauts underwent the study, 12 grams of daily salt. That's almost 3 teaspoons, or 8 times what the American Heart Association recommends. No negative health effects.
Wow.
You know, in fact, at that dose, those cosmonauts drank less and used their water so effectively that they excreted more bodily water, improved their metabolism and their immune function. You know, it's the opposite of what old studies from the 60s have shown.
That's amazing.
So what I'm saying is the research now is flipping things on its head. And when we've talked about previous research, it's always from 1950s, 1960s, early on, and we seem to stick with those. Mm-hmm. And then the medical community gets its hands on there and it starts to invent some kind of drugs to help with those effects. The new studies then are kind of muted. You know, we have, now we're saying, no, salt isn't actually bad for us, but why isn't this being blared in the headlines? Mm-hmm. You know, why do we still have to stick to a quarter teaspoon a day?
This is the type of thing that drives people crazy when it comes to nutritional science, is that it seems like today's study contradicts yesterday's study. The inherited wisdom so often is wrong. This was not good for us, and now it's good for us, or this what we thought was good for us is not good for us. You're confident that, say, the thing that they're saying today, that the studies that you're citing are absent maybe some of the problems that would skew results that we were hearing in those earlier studies.
Right. It seems like no amount of current scientific study is able to get rid of the suspicion that salt is unhealthy. Hmm. And it just gives the indication that governments have made a commitment to salt education that goes a little bit beyond scientific fact. Hmm. What's going on behind the scenes, you know? Are there commercial interests involved here? Are there medications that are going to go kaput, you know, if salt is used, or if we're saying salt is not good for you? Well, you don't need these medications. Mm. It's a $1 billion industry. You know, you just start to speculate and say, what's really behind it all?
Yeah, that's very interesting. So I've heard that not all salt is the same, that there are salts that maybe are not so good for you, but there are salts that are better for you. What would you say to that?
Well, if we're going to say that salt is a major cause of heart disease, then it's always wise to examine the quality of the product that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So today's table salt has very little in common with natural salt. One is harvested mechanically. So it's sort of like a pseudo food stripped of nutrients and with some added iodine, synthetic iodine, fluoride, anti-caking additives, bleaches to make it that pure white. The other is harvested naturally. It doesn't have any byproducts, any chemicals, and the end product after it's harvested has about 60 minerals intact, trace minerals, mm-hmm. but still, that's how the body likes to take in salt. It doesn't like a man-made product. So refined salt, they're given in the an example, can be compared to refined sugar, mm-hmm. which we know about, or refined flour. And they're no longer qualified as healthy foods. None of those. So refined salt is the same. Now, if we're taking in copious dietary amounts of refined salt without those trace minerals, yes, it's going to lead to higher blood pressure. You know, it's going to lead to an electrolyte imbalance. I mean, you can actually read those studies. There's a study in Food Nutrition Research that shows that natural salt has those benefits mainly because of the minerals and the enzymes. Mm. Because of those, and it nourishes the body rather than depleting it. So we're talking about potassium, calcium, magnesium, for example, that we know are anti-hypertensive. They're good for the heart. And there's also speculation that there's undetermined components in that salt that offer resistance to hypertension as well, you know? And you're not going to find any of that in table salt.
Okay. So if you're going to the grocery, you're buying the salt that you're going to put on the table or that you're going to be using in your cooking at home, what are you looking for?
Well, the ones that I look for Celtic sea salt or pink Himalayan rock salt. Make sure, though, that the label says unrefined. Some of those are not going to be unrefined. You do have to read. They're going to try to slip stuff by you. Marketing tricks. You know, you read the label and it's something else on the back. There's also a concern that if you're not eating iodized salt, you're going to have an iodine deficiency. And I would say, you know, just get some seaweed in your diet. Kelp is tremendous for getting some iodine. And other sources then would include seafood and dairy products, you know, eggs and such. So, but yeah, the quality is paramount. The quality of salt is paramount. I would say, you know, don't worry about how you season your food. Dash it on. Make sure your eggs have a flavor. You know, I eat eggs boiled. I'm not going to eat them without salt. Mm-hmm. But I'm also not eating out a lot, so I know I don't have a high salt intake. Whole foods always provide nutrients and good health. Man's tampering with food robs you of those nutrients and it brings disease. So there's a cacophony of conflicting information out there today, and people always tell me, hey, York, what do I believe? I'm being told this by my doctor, and you're saying this, and studies say this. You know, my advice is always eat simple, eat whole, use a moderate factor, of course, but then enjoy good health by following those examples.
Well, that is fantastic. We appreciate that very much, Jorg. We've been talking to certified holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian about the health benefits of the right kind of salt, healthy salt. He's preparing an article for thetrumpet.com about the subject. Thanks very much for your time, Jorg.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
The summer I turned 17 was somewhat of a low point in my relationship with my parents. It wasn't terrible, but it seemed we were arguing over more and more silly things. I thought they didn't trust me. They thought I was drifting away from them. But something happened that began to turn that relationship around. That summer, I spent 3 weeks in Orr, Minnesota at a summer educational program, SEP. It was a camp sponsored by my church. It was full of activity, sports, water skiing, a canoe trip, dorm life, dances, as well as instruction in Bible studies, fireside chats, fellowship with ministers. And I realized at that camp that I had not been honoring my parents as I should have been. I resolved that when I returned home, I would do my part to make the relationship better. I didn't realize it at the time, but this change in my attitude was actually fulfilling an Old Testament prophecy. In a letter he wrote in 1984, Herbert W. Armstrong, the man who founded the church I attended, the Worldwide Church of God, he wrote this: "Here in Australia, I have visited the SEP summer camp for youths 13 to 18 years of age. Words simply cannot describe the importance of these summer camps. These hundreds of young people will be adults being married and having children in just one decade. They are learning God's way of fun, and they're being taught God's truth. Their lives are being changed. These camps and the church YOU program for youths worldwide," and I'll talk about this in just a little bit, "they're turning the hearts of the children to their parents, and the parents to their children. And in this age when families are being broken up and youths are turning to alcohol, drugs, sex, and violence, and becoming strangers to their parents, that is one of the vital things God is doing through His church, as prophesied in Malachi 4 and verse 6. That's the prophecy I was talking about. And later in this letter, Mr. Armstrong wrote, "Not only are these summer camps of such supreme importance, but also our program of working with you parents so you may come closer to your children." He wrote this: "I call on you to have a closer relationship with your children. The last two verses of the Old Testament are a prophecy showing how important that is for you today." So this is what those verses say. Malachi 4, verses 5 to 6. "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Those words beautifully describe Mr. Armstrong's work. Over his 57-year ministry, he worked intensively to build families and turn hearts. The YOU program he mentioned was Youth Opportunities United. As a teen, I attended regular YOU sporting events, dances, talent showcases, fundraisers, and socials with my peers and my parents. In its publications, the church printed regular articles on marriage and family. They taught about dating, sex, childbirth, every aspect of every phase of parenting and child development, even grandparenting. Beginning in 1981, it began printing Youth Magazine for teens with frequent articles on building strong intergenerational relationships. Mr. Armstrong also founded three campuses of Ambassador College to teach true values to young people. Every effort was made to give graduating students the best possible foundation for happy, productive marriages and families. Ministers also offered counseling to couples considering marriage in order to help them build successful and enduring families. This was all specifically meant to fulfill Malachi's prophecy. It was a job Mr. Armstrong took very seriously. And at the heart of the issue was the deep biblical truth that we are preparing now to enter God's eternal family. That's why success in building our families today is so important. It gets us ready for our future. After Mr. Armstrong died in 1986, the Worldwide Church of God turned its back on this legacy of Bible-based family instruction. Within 4 years, though, the Philadelphia Church of God was founded. That's the church that sponsors this website and this radio broadcast. And right away, it resumed the work of turning the hearts of family members toward one another. We provide solid scriptural instruction on building strong families and many other topics in our magazines, The Trumpet, The Royal Vision, on our websites, thetrumpet.com and pcog.org. Our magazine, True Education, is for teens, and it helps young people navigate life and guides them toward closer relationships with their parents and with God. Ambassador College is now closed, but Herbert W. Armstrong College has filled the gap. Our ministers regularly provide marriage counseling and child-rearing help to our members, and we hold Philadelphia Youth Camp here in Edmond, Oklahoma, and in the Philippines and Australia. If we do our job right, we will help turn the hearts of these young people toward their fathers, just like mine was turned to my parents because of the work of Herbert W. Armstrong. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller and Jörg Mardian. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with this thought from Sir Francis Bacon. Nature is a labyrinth in which the very haste you move with will make you lose your way. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world. This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.